I think the work of crossing boundaries is absolutely, you know, more important than ever. And building real relationships with people, you know, online and offline, we have to do both because our lives are enmeshed in technology. Reaching beyond the people who already agree with us, finding some points of commonality.
Herzlich willkommen bei What's Left, dem linken Podcast zur US-Wahl. Eine Koproduktion der Schweizer Wochenzeitung WOTS und der deutschen Monatszeitung Analyse und Kritik. Mein Name ist Lukas Hermsmeier, ich arbeite als freier Journalist in New York und ich werde bis November mit verschiedenen Gästen über die dringendsten Themen dieses Landes sprechen. Die Wahlen in den USA sind vorbei, das Ergebnis ist extrem ernüchternd. Donald Trump wird im Januar wieder Präsident, die Republikaner haben in beiden Kammern des Kongresses die Mehrheit geholt. Es ist ein Desaster für die Demokratische Partei und damit auch für die Demokratie, für ökonomische Gerechtigkeit und Civil Rights, für den Schutz von Minderheiten, für Klimapolitik, denn all das wird Trump nicht liefern, sondern bekämpfen. Wie sind wir hier gelandet? Ich hoffe, dass dieser Podcast Antworten gegeben hat. Zur Frage, wie sich Trump über all die Jahre durchsetzen konnte, wie die Rechte in den USA generell funktioniert. Doch was ich für noch dringender halte, ist eine Auseinandersetzung mit der Demokratischen Partei, mit der Lehre, die ihre Politik hinterlässt, mit dem wirtschaftlichen System, das für die Masse nicht funktioniert. In dieser letzten Folge von What's Left geht es um die Wahlergebnisse und ihre Ursachen, darum, was uns erwartet in den kommenden 4 Jahren und worauf es ankommen wird, um Trump etwas Substanzielles entgegenzusetzen. Und ich freue mich, dass ich das mit 2 Gästen besprechen konnte. Zum einen die Filmemacherin, Autorin und Organizerin Astra Taylor. Astra befasst sich in ihren Werken mit den Spannungen der Demokratie und mit Solidarität. Sie war aktiv in der Occupy Wall Street Bewegung 2011, woraus die von ihr gegründete Organisation Debt Collective entstand, eine Gewerkschaft für verschuldete Menschen, die erste dieser Art in den USA. Mein anderer Gast ist der Wissenschaftler und Autor Jan-Werner Müller, der an der Princeton University politische Theorie lehrt und unter anderem zum Populismus forscht. Jan-Werner Müller hat in den vergangenen Jahren zahlreiche Bücher veröffentlicht, zum Teil preisgekrönt, zuletzt den Titel Freiheit, Gleichheit, Ungewissheit – Wie schafft man Demokratie? Hier sind Jan-Werner Müller und Astra Taylor. Dear Astra, dear Jan, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having me.
My first question for both of you, were you surprised by the outcome of this election or was it mostly what you expected?
So I was somewhat surprised. I never made any predictions, especially not about the future. But I maybe naively assumed that there was somehow a threshold which people would not cross in terms of, okay, I'm worried about inflation, I'm worried about the economy, but I also know who this man is, because at this point, everybody presumably knows who he is, and that this would somehow still put an obstacle in front of his success. So obviously it didn't turn out this way. It's not the first time that something like this has ever happened, but still, especially given the omnipresence of, you know, everything that he's done. And then also in particular, the Madison Square Garden event, where you really felt like, look, if you were really after voters in the center, this is not what you would do. Seemed to kind of encourage maybe some of us into thinking, okay, this is so over the top that it can't really go his way. And I will not make any further confessions or sadness-inducing statements after this point.
Astra, what about you?
I also didn't make any predictions because we've seen this before. We've seen Donald Trump win before. I certainly knew from my own social circles and from my organizing work that there was not a lot of enthusiasm for Joe Biden or Kamala Harris, which I found very concerning. And I would say that I'm very disappointed. There was a part of me, especially in the last week, that really wanted to hope she could squeak through. I thought it would be tight. I did not think she would lose so many critical battleground states. And, you know, it's not as devastating a loss in terms of the possible, in terms of the popular vote as it first appeared to be. But what I think we can say is that, you know, Trumpism has held steady. It's made inroads with, other with demographics that surprise us. And that the other side has got to do some deep rethinking moving forward.
Mm. Before we talk about the Democratic Party and the Republican Party and what's ahead of us, I would like to make or like get a better sense of what this election says about the quote-unquote American society, right? Because I feel like there is one extreme interpretation now that is saying, this is what America wants. America wants Trump. America wants whatever you want to call it, fascism, authoritarianism. And I'm, to be honest, skeptical for many reasons, not least because there are 100 million non-voters. And then there's a different extreme analysis saying, this is, America doesn't want that at all. This is only about cheaper groceries and cheaper rent. Like, where do you stand when it comes to the question of what this election result says about American society, the population here?
I think it's complicated. I spoke yesterday to a friend who runs a base building organization in North Carolina focused on Latino workers and voters. And they knocked 125,000 doors in Greensboro. And what she told me yesterday was that this was not an election between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump. It was actually an election between Kamala Harris, Donald Trump, and the sofa, right? Staying home. A whole lot of people stayed home. And it's really important to remember that. And her perception, again, talking to voters, was that, you know, a lot of them are not hardcore MAGA people, right? They were indeed voting based on their lived experience of high costs, of frustration with government services, and that these are people that aren't sort of lost to Trumpism for all time. So I think that the truth is complicated. I mean, if you talk to ordinary people, they're not really sort of, often they're not coherently on the left or the right. they hold a mix of views. And I think we have to engage people in that way. There is a strong authoritarian, even fascist streak in the United States. This is a country that hasn't been a real multiracial democracy ever, I would say, but is only approaching that within the last, 50 odd years, right? Since the 1960s, when we began to have things like the Voting Rights Act, when women were even allowed, women were even allowed to have full access to sort of the equality in the workplace and certain financial rights. I mean, we're new at this democracy thing, which means there's deep anti-democratic traditions. And so, I don't think this election really so much speaks to a change in the American character but it does set up conditions that really worry me, right? So, a big thing I think that motivates people is just distrust of government, of institutions. And when you have a party that is basically committed to wrecking those institutions, you're just going to create a sort of feedback loop, right? Where more and more people see evidence of the failures of the system. And the Democrats then are kind of stuck being the party that's defending those institutions. And they have to figure out a way to do that in a kind of anti-systemic way. And that's really tricky.
Mm. Jan, would you share that analysis? Do you want to add something?
Well, I second Astra's point that it's complicated, but headlines and pundits' claims are not complicated. And I think it's both, in all likelihood, empirically wrong and politically pernicious that, within just the last week, the outcome has been framed as, clear mandate for the far right, or, more or less along the lines which are very popular among the European commentariat, this is the populist wave that is now inevitably sort of rolling around the world. And even though Trump didn't do as well as Biden did in 2020, nobody in 2020 said, now it's Biden's country. This tells us something deep about the United States. So obviously it tells us something. And what it tells us, though, is not that there are people who are attracted to the far right. That's not new. What it tells us is that any country is in trouble if, for complicated reasons, voters in the end find themselves having a choice between the far right and, whatever you want to call the Democrats, mildly progressive, maybe center-left, maybe not even that, we can debate. Because on one level, citizens simply do what democratic theory tells them to do, which is in a two-party system, if you don't like the incumbent, you vote for the other guy. This is what people in Hungary thought they were doing in 2010. This is what people in Poland thought they were doing in 2015. They didn't say, hey, I want somebody who dismantles constitutional courts and, you know, unleashes hate against minorities and so on. They thought they were playing a normal game. With the caveat, as mentioned earlier, that this time around, it was so much in your face that this excuse doesn't entirely work. I mean, it's telling that both Orban in 2010 and Kaczynski in 2015 went out of their way to say, we are normal center-right parties. You know, the first time we were in power, maybe there were some funny things, but don't distrust us. You know, we're very moderate, etc. No risk here, nothing to see. And that, of course, went, you know, in a very different way. That's not the story that we've seen here. So hence, you know, you can't quite normalize everything. But I would simply underline that, you know, not only is this diagnosis empirically dubious, but it also develops its own dynamic, because the more you tell politicians, this is sort of the way the world now is, or if you tell them there is a wave which none of us can stop, or as Nigel Farage once put it, there's a tsunami. I mean, hey, none of us is gonna stop that sort of quasi-natural phenomenon. I'm not excusing their behavior, but it becomes more comprehensible why some of them would simply say, look, I have to adapt to this. You know, I have to get on board. This is just the way the world is now. And hey, my favorite pundit is telling me that too. So, I mean, I know it's a complete waste of time to appeal to, you know, certain pundits to kind of tone it down a bit or slow it down a bit. But I think sometimes people just aren't aware of how pernicious the consequences of these, you know, of these hot takes tend to be.
Astra?
But it's not just pundits, right? It's people in the Republican Party who have also all adopted the motif and vibe of Trumpism too. I mean, and I think in a two-party system, you know, the one thing is that if an extreme group captures the party, they have a whole lot of power because there's only one alternative besides staying home and sitting on the couch.
I agree with that as well. And maybe these are sort of two lessons that your European listeners and readers might find particularly instructive, that, I mean, it's not rocket science, but as by now, plenty of historians, social scientists, observers, intellectuals have said, alas, very often the fate of democracy hinges on the conduct of conservative elites. And once they've thrown in the towel, they can sort of put Humpty Dumpty back together again. Once, you know, to pick your favorite metaphor, the dam is broken or the firewall has crumbled or whatever, they can't turn around and say, oh, by the way, I actually thought this was a dangerous guy. And the other thing is that, of course, identities solidify over time. So I don't think that in 2015, 2016, there was a MAGA movement. But now, of course, people say, yeah, that's who I am. That's, you know, that's sort of what I want to do. So if you don't, I mean, to put it bluntly, if you don't stop it early on, if you somehow think this is going to solve itself, or, oh, this is so obviously irrational and crazy, it's going to, again, pick your favorite metaphor, the fever will break, it's going to burn itself out, etc. These things don't happen this way. And, you know, once enough time has passed, you cannot go back to 2015 and say, oh, now I figured out what we should have done. I mean, again, these are all banalities. But you hear plenty of voices in other countries where you still feel like, look, you're just watching all this and you think you guys stay in charge. But there is going to be a point, even though you think you are the elite actors, you will have lost control. And then what?
But that is also why the Democratic Party establishment is so afraid, though, I would say, right? Because they fear the same kind. They fear a hostile takeover. But they perceive as a hostile.
But I was wondering, because you both of you mentioned and emphasized that like right-wing authoritarianism is obviously not new, and we've seen this building. At the same time, what we have seen in this election obviously is a certain interesting and remarkable shift, that like more than half of Latino voters are voting now for the Republican Party, that like the working class, let's say, has become more diverse. Do you think that is an important thing and fact to reckon with? That like Trump's base is clearly, and that has been clear from the beginning, but now even more clear, not just a white phenomenon?
So I would again echo what Astra said earlier. We got to bear in mind just how many people stayed home. of course, you know, conservatives are very happy now to say, look, you know, who's actually building the multiracial working class alliance? I mean, there was always sort of, you know, rhetoric like that in 2020. But this is much more about who didn't turn up. The actual shifts are not that large. And as, you know, Philip Bump, for instance, I think pointed out yesterday, it's Trump's electorate is actually older, wealthier, and more or less as white as it was before. Yes, some small shifts, but it was much more about why certain people didn't turn up at all. I think that should be the primary question. Not reading too much into what ultimately are fairly minuscule shifts within sort of his coalition. So sorry to be so blunt in rejecting the question, but I think it's, again, it can have politically pernicious consequences if we now sort of repeat what ultimately is sort of, you know, a very self-interested framing of what has actually happened.
Astra?
Yes, and I think as we dig into the data, there's evidence for this as well, even in terms of who did vote for Trump. I mean, there was a lot of hand-wringing over Black men turning to Trump. Those numbers were small, right? I think that was overblown. When I have talked to my friends who, again, are deep in base building in the American South with Latinos, you know, they made two points. One is Latino is a broad category in the United States. It means people from different backgrounds, some of whom come from countries like Cuba, Venezuela, where actually the immigrants tend to be rather right wing. And that other people, for example, the folks whose doors were knocked in North Carolina, are actually the grocery voters. There are people who are saying, it's been really hard for me as a low-income person. There were harms to my business when COVID shut things down, and now I can't afford to make ends meet. And again, they're not sort of necessarily deeply embedded in the MAGA movement. And so I think that we shouldn't be complacent about the fact that you know, race is not something that we can just use as a proxy for party affiliation or political commitments. I think we should, in a way, I don't mind this message because I think it challenges liberals on the left to go, well, what would it take to actually build a multiracial working class that was deeply committed and not lose anyone to the Trumpist movement or to try to pull people back before it's too late? But I think we shouldn't read too much into this because it's the narrative that Donald Trump wants us to believe. And I think the data is a bit more complicated.
If we think about the millions of non-voters, as you have emphasized, and also the appeal Donald Trump has, it obviously leads us to the structural failures of the Democratic Party, right? And before we talk about the campaign, like shifting from Biden to Harris, what she and Walz have been emphasizing over the last month, maybe starting with you, Astra, what is wrong with that party very structurally? Big question.
No, I don't think it's a big question, but I think it has ultimately a pretty simple answer, which is that it's controlled by the donors. You know, we have two capitalist parties in the United States, and we have very few restrictions on money in politics. And, you know, those restrictions are going to be further eroded. Donors have a lot to do with the positions the Democratic Party takes. Some of us, and I put myself in this count, were optimistic that Harris might run a more economically populist campaign. I took the fact that she picked Tim Walz as her running mate as a good sign. But ultimately, she was very influenced by her Wall Street friends and colleagues, including her Uber executive brother-in-law, Tony West. There's been a lot of reporting in the American media on this, on just sort of the influence of Wall Street and on Silicon Valley donors, on the position she took and how she moderated very fast. And I would say, and by doing so sort of helped confuse voters or potential voters about what she stood for. But these are structural conditions in the Democratic Party, and they shape not just the agenda of that party, but how the party does voter engagement and door knocking. Mm-hmm. Because these are donors who don't want to build deep, lasting coalitions that, you know, shape political consciousness, that engage people year round, because a truly engaged small D Democratic base for the Democratic Party would sort of possibly pressure that party to take bolder, more inclusive, egalitarian positions. And so these donors also insist on a voter engagement method that emphasizes ad blitzes on cable television, that emphasizes just, you know, texting, door knocking, very shallow forms of reaching people. And that has huge implications for the party. And there's, I've been talking to people who are in that space, and a lot of the donors pulled out of voter engagement, actually, after Biden's 2020 win, because they didn't like some of the progressive policies he took. And so they wanted to defeat Trump, but they didn't want to see FDR come again, right? And so it's, you know, I just am saying that it goes beyond simply what we think of as the Democratic Party to their entire apparatus and where and how and where they connect with people. And, you know, whereas the right is very willing to sort of engage their extreme margins and sort of create a kind of culture, a sense of belonging and a real engagement, right? MAGA really is a culture. The Democratic Party, partly because of its, you know, again, its political economy, who funds it, you know, would rather just have voters come out and give them very, very squeaky margins. They'd like to win by, you know, one or two votes, but not really have mandates for any big progressive change. I think that's a big problem.
Jan, what are your thoughts on the structural problems of the Democratic Party? Do you share what Astra said?
So I know this sounds super unsatisfying and pedantic, but I'm not sure I'm in a position yet to sort of pinpoint, okay, if only she'd done this or they had done that. I'm not sure we ever will, of course, quite know. I agree that there's a lack of sustained engagement over time. Again, if you forgive a sort of transatlantic comparison, membership of a party means something very different here than it means in Europe. Now, obviously, around the globe, membership has been declining. There's been more volatility. But this very old-fashioned ideal of intra-party democracy, which sometimes is derided as, you know, who the hell wants that? You know, basically, it just means sitting around in a bar discussing, you know, old white men pontificating. They win the debate because they can stay up the longest, whereas everybody else has to get up early in the morning, go to work, take care of a kid, whatever. All these criticisms are fair on one level. On another level, though, it simply means that people aren't as engaged. It also means that you have, if I may put it in a very highfalutin way, it has a kind of epistemic costs because you have fewer ideas on the table. And switching into sort of the, by now, almost cliched sort of democracy protection mode, you have nothing like a legitimate opposition within a party. And if then a leader goes rogue, or, I mean, Trump didn't even go rogue. I mean, he simply, as one of our colleagues nicely put it, he didn't hijack the party. He understood the party. But there was nobody inside anymore to say, wait a minute, there's certain things you just can't do. And once these internal constraints have completely disappeared and you've basically turned the party into a personality cult plus sort of family enterprise, the road to January 6th and worse things to come now is open and nobody's going to hold you and nobody's going to hold you back. So even if you have no idealistic bone that says, oh, it'd be great to kind of get engaged over time, it's going to do good things for people. If for no other reason, you might say, look, this is sort of one of the checks that might occasionally in some countries actually work if things get really bad in terms of basically an aspiring autocrat.
Or the flip side of that, right, is to have a progressive, you know, takeover of the Democratic Party, right? I mean, where is the accountability for a loss like this? There's a whole world of consultants and strategists who are very invested in keeping their jobs. You know, and already we have to think about looking forward to possibly running progressive candidates in the 2028 primary as one side of intervention or showing some force in the 2026 midterms. But, you know, the American political parties are incredibly strange. They're hollow and yet very powerful, and how to transform them and, you know, wrest some control from the moneyed interests that have captured them is a really big strategic problem.
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, maybe worth underlining as a paradox that, yes, you have at the same time hollowed out parties, though one, I mean, as usual, this situation is not symmetrical. One is more hollowed out than the other. At the same time, high levels of polarization, again, not symmetrical, obviously, and a new quality with this election cycle of, you know, we don't usually use the word oligarch, you know, that only happens in Russia, supposedly, but de facto, a kind of structure in terms of, especially, of course, on the Republican side, people just coming in. And, you know, whether it truly made a difference or not, we don't know yet. But the very fact how it happened, how the court has further eroded, you know, these supposedly meaningful divisions between, you know, super PACs and the campaign, basically means it's sort of a free-for-all now in a way that, you know, it wasn't even 4 years ago.
Mm. And given these absolute structural problems the two parties have, and I'm more interested now to talk about the Democratic Party, because obviously that's the party more closer to us. Do you think that Harris ever stand a real chance, or was that almost impossible for her to overcome these structural problems? And if you think there was a real chance, what were the biggest mistakes in that campaign?
I mean, you know, I think the mistakes and the foibles of the Democratic Party go further back than this election. But I think it is important to begin the narrative with President Biden, who truly betrayed the trust of the nation by not stepping down earlier. And, you know, his advisors and the coterie around him that acted as though he was fit for office also did us a huge disservice. I mean, it has come out that internal polling that they were looking at showed that Donald Trump is going to win 400 electoral votes, an absolute landslide. Now, would that have happened? I don't know. My suspicion is Biden would have lost on an even grander scale than Harris. But, you know, certainly I think he should have stepped down. We should have had a primary. And he did run presenting himself as someone who would be a quote unquote transitional figure. So this was something he knew even back in 2020 would be an issue, his age, his ability to serve into his 80s. So a lot of blame for Biden. Harris was always at a disadvantage. I mean, she was not popular in the primaries. She in 2019, she was not a candidate who made it to the bitter end because she wasn't able to distinguish herself. She didn't feel credible to people. She has never been a great speaker. And then, you know, she inherited this, very unusual situation, very unpopular. War, high inflation, a lot of anger at costs, a MAGA movement that, as Jan said, is just gaining traction, right? I mean, she's also got to run a campaign in 100 plus days when Donald Trump has been campaigning since the day he left the White House. I mean, his operation had such a huge advantage, not just the normal scale, but he rallied in 2022, 2023, 2024, right? He's been campaigning this whole time. And so I think it would have been a difficult race for someone to win, and the truth is voters, again, people I've been speaking to who did that door knocking, who went and spoke to folks, were like, folks just didn't know who she was. They vaguely knew she was the vice president, but they didn't know anything about her. And so her strongest association was with Joe Biden, who is deeply unpopular. And Bidenomics means a lot of things to the Biden team, but to ordinary people, it actually meant high prices. And so his name really, unfortunately, was associated with something negative. Now, I'm all actually for governments taking credit for good stuff, but it should be a lot. They misdid that branding exercise. And so I think, the margins were close. It's easy to say she could have done X, Y, or Z, or another candidate could have succeeded where she failed. But she did have many things stacked against her. And I think her gender was one of them. I mean, because we do live in a very misogynistic society here. But when you look at the messaging on the far right, it has become increasingly almost brutally sexist. And in fact, there was a very disturbing spike in the number of explicitly misogynist threatening messages to women all over the United States when she lost. Essentially, the meme was, your body, my choice. And so, I think she's someone who should have run with clear economic populist policies. And, I'm a leftist, but, there was a lot of stuff just in the culture and in the conditions that she was working against. And so here we are.
Mm. Yeah, I would underline this one point about basically misogyny. So now people tend to say, "Oh, but look, other countries have elected female leaders," but people have forgotten what it took for that to happen, and how even the first time when some leaders who were expected to win landslides, like Merkel in 2005, didn't. And turns out the most obvious explanation in the end was the correct one that people simply couldn't imagine. I mean, somebody in this position. I would just add three, again, tentative points, the usual pedantic caveats about how little we know at this point. One is simply that they just seem to have, I mean, the Democratic Party seems to have doubled down on a 2022 strategy, which maybe wasn't crazy. I mean, whether they should have embraced the Cheneys in quite the way they did, you know, we can debate. But it seemed a little bit like, you know, generals fighting the last war and thinking that it was going to be exactly like this. And plus, they didn't really win in 2020 either. And then secondly, I mean, this is a banality, but still, because goes to the point about what you say on the doorstep, whatever we think about the wall, it's an incredibly powerful political symbol. You just mentioned that and people know what Trump stands for. And unlike what some observers said, it's not that, you know, Harris didn't have any policies. I mean, you know, we might say he should have been more ambitious, but there was something there in terms of how to, you know, help people with housing, et cetera, et cetera. But it never was condensed as this one thing that you simply had to kind of pinpoint and say, oh, just imagine this. Imagine how your life will be different if X. And that's an art in politics, obviously. And, you know, I'm not a campaign advisor, but I'm surprised that in the end, nobody came up with anything where you felt like, look, this is really the one thing that will pinpoint it. And lastly, this is a pet theory. So I'm again, all the caveats about this might be totally wrong, but I've been asking myself, you know, how did Republicans mobilize so successfully? It's one thing to be unhappy with the economy, but there's still this, okay, but I'm actually going to go and think I'm doing something about it. Never mind that the opposite is going to happen of what I think will happen. And the pet theory is simply that, in a sense, what has been happening with Trump over the last couple of years has a kind of narrative slash dramatic structure. I mean, if somebody invented this, including the assassination attempts and the court case and everything else, people would say, look, Hollywood is not going to buy that. I mean, this just seems too much, you know, too many twists in the plot, etc. But I could just imagine that, almost like a video game, at a certain point somebody says, and I can finally now participate in making the whole story having a nice ending in the way that I wanted to have it. And all I have to do is, you know, turn up somewhere on one day and cast a ballot. I'm not saying it's the explanation, but there is something, I think, to this particular structure of how his story has developed and how he's basically managed to grab people with this fight, fight, fight. And now you can fight with me and for me and make a contribution. Obviously, Harris also had arguments as to what was at stake. So it's not totally asymmetrical. But given that Trump is the most public American who's ever lived, given that he's always been made through television, that he's always been a media personality above everything else, I could just imagine there's something additional going on that in a close-fought contest might have made some difference.
Mm.
He also, of course, is playing into deep American iconography, the entrepreneur, the successful businessman, right? So he's working with the grain of the culture instead of trying to break in as something new, right? The first woman president. But I think you're really right about narrative and how this is portrayed as almost like a battle of good versus evil. But it also provides amazing belonging. People aren't just feeling as though they're just passively watching Trump. If you listen to the Steve Bannon podcast, it's we. Things are happening to us. They build a sort of web of belonging, inclusion, connection to folks who are otherwise very atomized in our society, right? There's lots of evidence showing how lonely people are, how isolated, how social bonds have been diminished. And when you listen to the right-wing media, it really is us and them, and the us is really strong. Liberals laughed at Trump's ground game. There's a lot of tweets and articles mocking his lack of a ground game. But when you look, he had a ground game. It looked different. Instead of just micro-targeting people, they would give people Trump hats and say, bring 10 friends and give them hats, right? Give them these symbols of belonging. So, and so that's going to a deeper level that is really important in politics, right? And that's part of what the appeal is and part of why it's going to be so hard to get out of, to break this fever, right? To use that phrase, because it really is identity at a certain point for some people, not all of the people who voted for Trump, but for a good big chunk of them.
Warum spricht das, was Trump macht und sagt, so viele Menschen an? Wir müssen uns mit dieser Frage tiefer beschäftigen, sagen Astrid Taylor und Jan Werner Müller. Denn selbst nach all den Jahren, in denen Trump so dauerpräsent ist, wird er immer noch in seiner Wirkung unterschätzt. Trump liefert eine Erzählung, die Sündenböcke und Gegner stehen fest und er bietet Zugehörigkeit an, wir gegen das System. Bei den Demokraten hingegen ist viel zu unklar, wofür sie stehen und was sie wollen. Sowohl Astra Taylor als auch Jan Werner Müller haben erklärt, dass das ein Hauptgrund ist, warum sich so viele Menschen von den Democrats abgewandt haben. Fast 100 Millionen Wahlberechtigte haben in diesem Jahr nicht gewählt. In der zweiten Hälfte unseres Gespräches geht es darum, was uns konkret in den kommenden 4 Jahren erwartet, von Trump und von rechts. Und was von liberaler und linker Seite kommen muss. Der What's Left Podcast zu den US-Wahlen ist eine Koproduktion der Schweizer Wochenzeitung WOTS und der deutschen Monatszeitung Analyse und Kritik. Beide Redaktionen haben Personal und Zeit investiert. Finanziert wird der Podcast vom Recherchierfonds ProWOTS. Wenn Sie mithelfen wollen, dass Projekte dieser Art auch in Zukunft umgesetzt werden können, spenden Sie auf provots.ch und abonnieren Sie eine oder gleich beide Zeitungen. Astra, you wrote a book called Democracy May Not Exist, But We'll Miss It When It's Gone, which I think is still a very remarkable title, because it is, I feel this ambivalence. Do you think we will get closer to this in the next years, the second part of it?
Yeah, I do.
Democracy being gone?
I think that we're already seeing signs of it in terms of the names that are being floated as Trump's cabinet members. These are people who are not friends of democracy. We're seeing it in terms of the threats being made to weaponize the IRS and the tax code against civil society groups. We're seeing it in the capture of the judicial system. I mean, Trump's going to be able to appoint hundreds of judges, you know, at the district and circuit level, on top of probably getting to appoint a couple Supreme Court judges. You know, and this is building, again, going with the grain of American quote unquote democracy, which is, you know, has many veto points in it, right? Like it already is a system of minority rule. I mean, we have, you know, a strange system that gives the Senate a lot of weight, but, you know, each state gets 2 senators. And so that means that, you know, this is hardly a system that is a sort of one person, one equally weighted vote kind of democratic system. I also think, you know, when we think about a democracy and its erosion, that we also just have to think about inequality and the concentration of wealth and the power that wealth buys. And these folks are in it to get rich. We've got this absurd, you know, group of billionaires around Donald Trump right now, and they are in it for the cash grab. And so these folks are just going to get richer. They'll keep eroding what, you know, restrictions there are on campaign finance reform. You know, there's a lot of wealth in the United States to plunder. This is one thing I just kept trying to explain to people. Is, you know, there's a long way we can fall. There's a lot of parts to be stripped in this society. And that's, I think, what we're going to see. And I'm an organizer, so I have my pet theories about what we can do and how best we can mobilize and organize and educate and rabble rouse. But, you know, yeah, this is, you know, I would prefer to be, you know, building on liberal democracy's flawed systems instead of seeing people who are just sort of proudly authoritarian break things that took decades, if not centuries, to make. I mean, you know, it's to me, it's really tragic. These are folks who would prefer capitalism to democracy. There's none of that sort of Reagan rhetoric that those two are entwined. You know, this is a different Republican Party, you know.
Jan, what do you expect from the second Trump term? How different
will
it be from the
first one? So I'm generally skeptical of be it geographical or historical analogies. You know, oh, it's going to be exactly like Hungary. Oh, it's going to be exactly like the 30s. No, but then again, it's not all random. There are certain patterns. And when I listen to observers and, alas, sometimes colleagues who say, but look, stop the alarmism, 2017 to 21, with the exception of January 21, it wasn't so bad, you know, tone it down. It was all rhetoric. I'm amazed that people don't see one of these patterns, that it's always the second time when aspiring autocrats get into power and when they've, I mean, whether they've personally learned something we can debate, but the people around them, around him, it's usually a man, of course, they certainly have learned something. And this is no longer news, that this time they're prepared. And one of the things they've learned is that, you know, don't spend too much political capital on culture war. Capture the institutions, which means capture the bureaucracy, capture the judiciary. Once you have those, you can do culture war to your heart's content later on. Nobody's going to stop you. You can go after all the artists and civil society organizations and professors, of course, as you know, as you see fit. Plus, once you know the state as such is more or less on your side, it's open. It's an open road for kleptocracy. And those who benefit from that, in turn, will support you politically, including by buying up media organizations, which then give you favorable, you know, coverage for the next election. So you see how sort of things go in this direction. And a lot of things can happen without sort of, you know, fraud on the election day or anybody stuffing ballot boxes. And that's an entirely plausible scenario. The one thing that, I mean, we can have a long discussion about strategies to counter this. The one thing that I think is important to bear in mind is that, of course, this is a complicated, very large country. And it's also decentralized in many ways. In Hungary, for instance, once you had parliament, once you had the court, once you had the presidency, it was game over for democracy. There was no foothold for anything else. Whereas here already last time, all of a sudden there were interesting voices who said, look, especially people on the left, of course, were not exactly fans of federalism. I mean, the one thing that always shielded racist practices from, you know, federal interventions. But now there was also a sense that, look, you know, if push comes to shove, this might give you a foothold under certain circumstances. And again, as a footnote to maybe some European listeners, as you know, so federalism is in the so-called eternity clause in the German basic law. You know, the thing you cannot change, like democracy, basic rights. And sometimes people kind of derided this and said, come on, if Bavaria disappears tomorrow, a little bit less folklore, but, you know, democracy will be fine. And then you want to say, no, maybe the mothers and fathers of this basic law kind of had some important insight into if all else fails, if you distribute power, it can at least give you a fighting chance, as opposed to bang, capture these three institutions and nobody else, you know, will really know how to kind of find any. I mean, there's always organizing, but sort of as an institutional foothold where you can say, okay, you can still bring in the lawyers, you can kind of do something official in a way that at least slows things down.
I think the federalism piece is also important, not just for protecting what can be protected from Trumpism, but ideally demonstrating to some portion of the public that there can be decent governance. Because part of what Trumpism thrives on is a sense that nothing ever works. The systems are so corrupt. And so I believe that we have to think about it in that dual way, right? That there's actually, these are not just sort of, you know, islands of resistance to autocracy and kleptocracy, but also staging grounds for policies that could perhaps make people's lives a bit better, to give some sense that, you know, it's actually worth it to politically engage and elect different kinds of people.
But that already exists, right? I completely agree with you. And it's so important to point to certain cities and states and say, like, hey, you have more rights here. But that already exists. The difference between, like, certain laws in Alabama to Brooklyn,
yes,
that is...
Yes, but then I'm sitting in Brooklyn, and
vast,
we also have Eric Adams as a mayor who's, you know, embedded within corruption charges. And I think in that sense, you know, there has to be a kind of cleaning of the Democratic House, too, if we want to demonstrate, you know, to make that more deeply felt, you know. But yes, I hear you, right? There's a large variation across this massive country. But I think the stakes are just going to get even higher.
Mm. If we think about the next years again, connected to my first question, Trump in the last 8 years has been promising so much, right? Like if you look at Agenda 2025, Project 2025, it's a massive agenda. Is that... more an advantage because he can just pick a few things and then people forget about the other things and there will never be a thing like broken promises? Or is there also a potential of like, he has given, laid out this like big vision of like dismantling the Department of Education, deporting millions, and he might not be able to do that. What do you think? Is there like a contradiction, or is that just he will pick some priorities and then we will forget about all the other things that he's also promised? I'm old enough to remember,
what was it again? Some promise about somebody's going to build a wall and some other country was going to pay for it. Clearly, he was massively penalized for having broken that promise. That. So I don't see this as a major factor. What I could imagine is simply that, you know, Trumpism has become a career. So now many people are entering and many people want to do stuff and many people will do very bad things, not because Trump necessarily even wants them or even Vance, you know, wants them, but it's sort of working towards the leader in terms of, oh, I'm going to please them by doing something totally, you know, awful in a certain way. So it's, you know, whatever happens on the ground ultimately might not even have been in the program, but somebody who, you know, wants to distinguish themselves with some especially horrific sort of idea, all that can happen. And as again, we've seen already, reasonable observers might say, wow, this is all pretty chaotic. And yet there's no obvious price to be paid for that.
Do you have thoughts on that, Astra? And I'm obviously, I don't want to like sound naive exactly that like broken promises lead to anything necessarily, but I do also see a chance at the, or like an option of like exhaustion, right? At some point, maybe Trump also will be exhausted, but maybe also not in the next 4 years.
Something like Project 2025, you know, if you polled a lot of the individual elements of that 900-page document with his supporters, I don't think they'd actually rate them highly. You know, there are things that stood out, right? Like he knows that bashing immigrants plays well, and he's done a lot to feed that fire. Building a wall, mass deportations, you know, revenge is a big thing that seems to play well with the base, but also promises that he'll economically improve people's lives. So I would say the promise that might matter is that one, as opposed to the promises laid out in Project 2025, which we know a bunch of think tank folks wrote and the public didn't, you know, deeply engage. And that's where, you know, I have a hard time believing that anything he does is actually going to improve people's circumstances. You know, these high tariffs are not going to benefit the average consumer. You know, there's some concern that he might reap the benefit of some Biden investments. That seems credible to me. I'm not an economist. But, you know, what the opposition, I think, will have to call attention to are, you know, whether people's lives really are improved, right? And also to this element of kleptocracy, which I think is going to be a way to accurately describe his administration, you know, to show, to demonstrate how much self-dealing is going on, not just by, you know, Trump and his family, but his cronies and the larger circle, many of whom have, you know, strong corporate ties that I think would be pretty repellent to a lot of folks, certainly folks who sat out this election and some folks within who are less deeply embedded in the Trump coalition. So, you know, but he's promise proof, right? I mean, he's one of these political figures who is kind of promise proof. That's not the world he's operating in. We have to look for different opportunities.
The one thing I would add is that, I mean, so the point about exhaustion is an important one. But as many people have pointed out, you now have a VP who, you know, has ideas. And has people behind him, the self-declared post-liberals, yes. Actually just anti-liberals, of course.
Yes.
Who have plenty of ideas about the unitary executive, about what's wrong with universities, and who are itching to put some of that into practice. So it's not quite the same as George W. Bush and Cheney, but it's clearly not the same as the first time around in terms of having a sort of factotum who was simply there to, you know, vaguely appeal to evangelicals. So whatever vacuum might be created is going to be filled by people who, A, have ideas and who maybe on a less obvious note also, I mean, I'm not saying this is the ultimate truth about Trump or that it matters a great deal, but, you know, he will occasionally sort of almost have moments of sort of winking and self-irony and, you know, doing stuff which a fascist leader would never do, in my humble opinion. That doesn't mean that Vance is fascist, but the people behind him have this kind of, we are serious intellectuals, you know, and we are not questioning anything. And we are sort of doubling down on these fantastic, you know, learned ideas that we have. So that's actually much more dangerous in a certain way than what we saw before.
To just underscore your point, I mean, the unitary executive, these are people who openly talk about monarchism, who have said that it was a mistake for women to be enfranchised given the right to vote. I mean, these people are so deeply and proudly anti-democratic, as though it were this amazingly erudite position to take. I mean, and they're incredibly wealthy. I agree that these are the people who will care about promises kept. And even if promises aren't kept, they'll do anything to hold on to power.
Given that the White House, the Senate, most likely the House, the Supreme Court, all these institutions are now in the hand of this one party, basically, do you see any elements of so-called checks and balances that we can to some degree rely on? Or is that not the, is that basically a hopeless approach? And we have to think about, and that will be my next question then, mass movement building, changing maybe the democratic body and everything. Or is there something still about the liberal institutions, the state institutions that we can, count on?
He has a trifecta. It's terrifying. You know, there will be lawyers. I know that they've been readying themselves for this moment, who will try to intervene in the courts and hopefully be as savvy about judge shopping as their right-wing opponents are. Elections are still happening. And so I think thinking about the midterms is going to be absolutely critical. And federalism, right? Where can this, we can resist at the state levels? I mean, you know, but at the nationally, it's alarming.
So most of the institutions by now don't have a great track record. And the ultimate check was going to be us at the ballot box. And that didn't really work out either, as some of us may have hoped. Now, that doesn't mean all is lost. As Astra was saying, there are plenty of, in a sense, counter elites left. There are plenty of people left who hopefully have the energy to organize on the ground. But again, I would emphasize that contrary to the stereotype that, oh, all the authoritarians, you know, are stupid, basically, they're all going to end like the Soviet Union. Democracies make mistakes all the time, so we're the only ones who can learn. I mean, they are learning too. God forbid, some of them might be even reading what we write. And in terms of saying, oh yeah, we can anticipate, you know, what they're going to do as the next move. I mean, Bannon was already, I guess, famous for saying, you know, resistance, bring it on. I mean, the more you have people out there on the street, kind of, you know, allowing us to play our game and allowing us to frame them in a certain way, the better. So that, I think, is a, you know, it's not rocket science. It's not impossible to figure this out, but it's also clear that there needs to be some reckoning why certain things haven't worked, both here and in other countries, how one does not become part of their dramaturgy inadvertently in certain ways, and how you basically, you know, maybe going back to figures like Alinsky, sort of start to play jujitsu again, or kind of really think two steps ahead in terms of, okay, how do you make them react in certain ways? How do you make them look in a certain way? As opposed to, oh, we're just all very well-meaning and we'll now do another demonstration, which I don't mean to ridicule. It's just, I think it is important to have a sort of moment of reflexivity, especially after, you know, a development that, again, few of us maybe anticipated quite to this extent.
What do you think will be most important in the coming years? Because there are obviously very different approaches. I see it with among my leftist friends, where they have different priorities now. Some invest almost all their energy in like hyper-local anti-fascist networks and think about like, how do we protect immigrants from January on? And then other already thinking a little bit more about like, who do we put up for the primaries in 2028? You know, generally speaking, what do you think should be the priorities to oppose Trump's agenda in the next months, but also years? Like, is it about mass movement building? Is it keep doing what has been done in the last years, like tenants' unions, labor unions? What should be the priorities of the opposition?
Well, I'm very curious for any lessons from other countries about what might work, but maybe I'll answer first to tell you what I'm seeing. I mean, I think when we talk about the erosion of institutions and government, I think we should also talk about how the right has systematically attacked sort of institution of small d democratic power. So decades of litigation against labor unions, the passage of right to work laws that make it very difficult for labor unions to get a foothold, especially across the U.S. South. Explicit attacks actually on student unions and student infrastructure, going after student fees to make it harder for students to have organizations that represent their interests, while also funding to an astonishing degree right-wing student networks, so that there is a whole sort of pipeline to cultivate young right-wing thought leaders, if I could dignify them in that way. So that kind of infrastructure has also been under attack. And those are kinds of checks and balances. And I think the right was very strategic to be like, how can we actually, you know, attack the forms that through which ordinary people, you know, express sort of extra electoral power and influence? I mean, I think we always have to operate on two timescales at once. This is sort of one of the democratic paradoxes, right? So I'm thrilled that there are people who are thinking about mutual aid networks, immigration defense, right? These kinds of urgent fights, because we need that. I think it's that kind of deep hyperlocal work, but that does need to be coupled with thinking about what it would take to realign the Democratic Party, because the way our elections are structured in this country, we live in a two-party system. And unfortunately, this is the vehicle for counter-Trump aspirations. You know, it's frustrating, but there has to be a battle over that. So I think thinking about the midterms and the primaries, you know, and to do that, I think we need to create institutions that are not subsumed by the Democratic Party, but that cultivate political analysis, political education, political power. So there are so many groups that could fall into that rubric. I mean, your local Democratic Socialists of America chapter, your local tenant union, there's groups called Indivisible that have been mobilizing folks who are concerned about political dynamics. You know, essentially, my advice to people is always join something, right? Join something where your power can be aggregated with others. You can't address this as an isolated individual. I also take hope in the fact that American labor unions have been calling for a general strike in 2028 and aligning contracts. We're talking about teachers. We're talking about the United Auto Workers for May of 2028. That's a very ambitious scale. That's a very ambitious thing to even imagine in the United States of America. But it's something, because it's coming from credible sources, namely some of the biggest labor unions in the country, it feels very significant to me. So I think these sort of civil society groups should think about how they could be part of that, how we could work towards that in this critical upcoming election year to show people are really engaged, not just with the ballot box, but in showing a kind of, resistance that goes beyond simply showing up at a demonstration. Because the fact is, you know, we've had some of the biggest demonstrations, in fact, the biggest demonstrations in history in this country in recent memory, and a one-day event just doesn't cut it. We really have to build durable infrastructure that is guided by a vision of a better future, that has strategies about how to get there, that can keep people engaged on a deep level. This doesn't mean just turning out Democratic voters. It means turning out small-D Democratic citizens. And that infrastructure is, you know, hard work, but I think it's really what this is going to take. I think one thing I can say about this moment is, you know, I think we need to take it and think not just in terms of like immediate wins, but really years and decades. How do we work for a generational shift? Because, even if we get rid of Trump, the appointees he's got are going to have lasting political effects, right? Judges don't just serve for 2 4-year four-year terms, right? They serve often for their lives. And so we have to think on that timescale.
Jan, what do you think? What is most important in the coming years?
The first one is actually that I don't think there's a global answer in terms of, you know, here are the top 10 priorities that we can decree from on high, and whoever now doesn't do number one, there's something wrong with them and they should be faulted. Very much depends on where people find themselves, who they know, what they know, who they might draw in because of, you know, people they know and who might trust them to become more involved politically. So it's very context dependent in all kinds of ways. Secondly, though, you know, many of us find ourselves within certain institutions already. And I think it's not a wild prediction that a lot of these institutions will be under enormous pressure. There'll be attempts to make them complicit in all kinds of ways. That's sometimes going to be obvious. Sometimes it's not going to be obvious. And so to basically keep out an eye for the integrity of institutions, which again can sound like the by now old and tired, oh, norms and institutions and so on. But if it's not like an institution that you look to some far away, oh, the court should do X, but along the lines of I'm in this and I can either sort of remain engaged with what's actually happening to my institution and how it might sort of, you know, send signals that, yes, we're on board with the new national agenda and so on. I mean, again, this is what has happened in many other countries, that there are sort of, you know, flagrant examples like Orban shutting down a university. But a lot of the other stuff is much more subtle. And it's much harder to find this moment when you say, wait a minute, now I really have to say stop or I have to sort of do something. So that's point number two. And point number three is that, again, there are no sort of general manuals with, you know, here 10 bullet points, follow this and you will win against the far right. But if you look at recent examples like what happened in Poland and to some degree in France this past summer, it seems not a crazy conclusion that you certainly do need fairly broad coalitions. But these coalitions themselves also need to find a way of, on the one hand, really saying something about democracy, but not just in the kind of conservative, oh, let's save what is already great, but at the same time sort of very concretely saying, and this is how your life is going to be better if you go with our side. Now, obviously, in the end, in France, this went in a very different way than some people had hoped and imagined. But on the ground, it was a very impressive effort, and it kind of proceeded on the two levels at the same time. And that's, again, that's an art, and you have to find the right symbols, the right language to make that plausible. Again, it all comes down maybe to the doorstep or a super quick engagement on social media. And if you can't get that across, then, you know, especially in light of the fact that the other side has, you know, as everybody knows, a more or less self-enclosed right-wing media ecosphere, is now seemingly capturing a world of influencers in a way that's become very powerful, it seems. That's going to be very important. But there are no manuals with, there are no bullet points, there are no, you know, just take this book off the shelf and that'll teach you.
I mean, Timothy Snyder wants us to believe that, but the 10 points. Now, regarding point two you made, Jan, are you thinking about your own university? Do you think like you have to be, there's even more responsibility now, what like a big institution like this is doing, how they might engage with certain state policies?
So again,
was that as concrete as I understood it?
I've often heard people say, look, you know, what's happening in red states, what's happening in Florida is horrible, but we're basically the island of the blessed and we're the privilegentia of sorts and nothing bad can happen. And I always thought that was pretty naive in many ways. They, meaning Vance and friends, have declared universities the enemy. Project 2025 will not only, if it goes their way, abolish the Department of Education. They also have lovely things like no more area studies, instead patriotic education that tells people why free markets are good and so on. Again, it doesn't mean that all these things will be implemented, but there's no reason why they wouldn't, you know, push as far as they can, especially if they think, and empirically that's an open question, but if they think that A, this is relatively costless, and B, it plays well with a certain kind of base. And again, it's astonishing how some commentators are already saying, oh, but Trump got a mandate from non-college educated voters. No, he didn't. You know, that's not what this election was about. This is, again, some kind of, dare I say, typical, also very sentimental kind of liberal overreach a la hillbilly elegy in terms of, oh, now we have the kind of stereotypical image of what certain people are like and we attribute certain motivations to them. And now we kind of have to, you know, to coin a phrase, obey in advance in terms of, oh, let's make all these concessions because 2/3 of, you know, self-identified Republican voters think that universities are bad for the country. Well, they didn't come up with this by themselves all of a sudden. And it would be a terrible mistake to say, oh, you know, we can save ourselves if we now sort of make concessions or kind of give hints that we're on board with a new program. Now, it doesn't mean that, you know, all professors now day and night have to whatever, do resistance work and so on. But some deeper understanding of how these processes work, I think might be helpful.
I mean, it's true. Astra? This is that there was a kind of cultural hostility to the elites, right? And the Republicans want us to believe that these are professors as opposed to corporate executives. But if you look at the polling, you know, I work on the issue of education, student debt cancellation. Free public college is very popular with Republicans. It's more popular with people who have not gone to college, who have no college degrees, than people with degrees. And so, you know, this is where there needs to be a reckoning with the Democratic Party. What if you went out there and said boldly, we're offering a plan for free public college where anyone who wants to get educated at any stage of their life can access that opportunity, as well as fighting for you to have a dignified living wage at your job, regardless of whether you've gone to college or not, right? That's the kind of talk that can short circuit Republican talking points and possibly reach people, right? And I think also, you know, we need to be real about why attacking universities are so important. Just like the right wing attacked labor unions, just like they're attacking student power, they see universities as sites of social reproduction, right? As sites where people's horizons are expanded, where they encounter liberal values, and I mean liberal in the best sense of the word, and they understand that these are spaces of subjectivity formation, and they despise that. And so I think that's something that we should be far bolder in defending. And the Democratic Party has promoted the idea of neoliberal education as mere job training, a return on investment, allowed for this huge disparity between elite institutions and Ivy League schools and for-profit colleges that exploit the poor. And they set the stage for these maniacs. And we need a reckoning with those sorts of policies so that we can offer something that actually gives people a vision of a future that's worth fighting for.
I would just maybe add one point, if I may, because again, it might be interesting for European listeners or readers. In a sense, it's also been a bipartisan tendency to essentially say, yeah, civic education would be nice, but who has time for that? Because STEM has to dominate everything because, you know, China is at our heels, etc. Now, I don't mean civic education as in, you know, tell people how many branches of government there are. But if you think about the old Dewean idea, the school as a site of democracy where people kind of learn how to deal with differences, all that has de facto disappeared from as a space, because even well-meaning people say, oh, we don't have time for that. Or maybe more subtly, sometimes teachers will say, look, I would love to do that, but nobody trained me for this. And I worry that my classroom will explode. So God, don't get me wrong. I'm not against, you know, community service and all these things. But in many ways, there's been this push in that direction. And it has displaced more directly political forms of education, because that's in a sense safe. And kids love it because they can put it on their CV, etc. But it's actually not the same as being in a school, making time and space for let's talk politics, let's find ways of basically engaging with each other, learning how to deal with disagreement, doing conflict in a way that, you know, as the cliche has it, is productive in a certain way. And that's been a global trend to say, oh, we don't have time for this. Who needs this? You know, let's have more maths, et cetera, et cetera.
My last question would be, how much will this win for Trump change your work directed now at you, Astra, specifically your organizing work with the Debt Collective? Or will you basically continue what you have been doing? And I think one of the most crucial parts, looking at your work from with a distance, obviously, I don't know the inside, is that like you reach out to Republican voters, right? It is not like a progressive bubble work. You have people who are indebted because of medical things or student debt, and it's often also Republicans, obviously. Is that, how will it change your work? And is it even more crucial now to do that kind of work where you
across boundaries is absolutely, you know, more important than ever. And building real relationships with people, you know, online and offline, we have to do both because our lives are enmeshed in technology. Reaching beyond the people who already agree with us, finding some points of commonality. And I believe that our commonality often is our exploitation, right? We're poor, we're middle class, and we're afraid we're going to get cancer in this country and our financial lives are going to get ruined, right? So the Debt Collective uses indebtedness is a point of contact to, you know, build trust by saying, look, we see you, we see your struggles. We're going to try to help you get debt cancellation. But also, do you know what would really solve this, right? You wouldn't have credit card debt if the financial sector was regulated and if your job paid you fairly. You wouldn't have medical debt if there was universal health care. You wouldn't have student debt if there was free college as a right. And when you do that, when you talk about people's material struggles, you can short circuit the political categories they're in a bit, right? You can get them to start to see the commonalities they have with people who are different ages, different races, who live in different geographies. I mean, that's the important work that we have to do. So, you know, we know that we will have less, there will be less of a focus on the Department of Education in a Trump administration. We already organized through the first Trump administration. Their number one priority was actually eliminating the legal protections that we were organizing around. We expect this administration to be even more hostile, but there's still lots of work we can do on the state and local level that is as much about winning debt relief for folks as it is, again, about building those relationships and those connections that can get people thinking on a deeper level about politics and what they're entitled to. I mean, what organizing has really taught me is that economic issues are always emotional issues, right? That you kind of can't disentangle sort of people's financial situations from affect, that it's just really powerful stuff. And right now, you know, again, it's the right wing who's really talking to people's discontent. So I think we need to build structures that can do that work, but pull people in a different direction. So I'm not happy to be organizing on this terrain, but this is where it's at. And we have to make do. But I think we need to burrow in and really think about shifts on a deeper level, not just winning at the margins, not just persuading a few persuadable people, but how do you really get people thinking differently, not just about the political parties, but what they're entitled to as human beings.
Astra, Jan, thank you so much for taking the time. I very much appreciate your thoughts, and we'll hopefully continue organizing, talking to each other. Thank you so much. Es wird in den kommenden Jahren darum gehen, sagt Jan-Werner Müller, genau hinzuschauen, was die Institutionen, in denen wir uns bewegen, machen und inwiefern sie sich womöglich auch mitschuldig machen, wenn es um den Abbau der Demokratie geht. Astra Taylor meinte an einer Stelle, join something. Wer von der Politik frustriert ist, wer Angst vor Trump hat, sollte einer progressiven Gruppe oder Gewerkschaft beitreten, sich kollektiv organisieren. Das war die letzte Folge von What's Left. Ich möchte mich bei allen ZuhörerInnen bedanken und auch beim großartigen Podcast-Team, bei den Redaktionen der WOTS und Analyse und Kritik. Bis bald. Dieser Podcast ist eine Koproduktion von der WOTS und Analyse und Kritik, finanziert durch den WOTS Recherchierfonds. Am Podcast beteiligt sind Ur Gültekin, Kaspar Surber, Jan-Ole Arps, Payam Masumi, Helen Derik und Lukas Hermsmeier.